from an undisclosable location for reasons of security and therefore insecurity. Cometh the hour, cometh the mothership, that is, Coast to Coast AM. We'll just set her down gently. All right, there we are. Good evening, everybody. John B. Wells in with you for the night. I hope you've had a good week. And tonight, we have a program I think that you will like. We have brought back from just 2 weeks ago, Douglas Dietrich. He'll be with us for the first hour. That's Son of a Sailor. He has some interesting perspectives on the Vietnam conflict. And not only that, he is a great proponent of an official National Day of Commemoration for those who served that long, long war. He will give us some insights on many things, including what year the first American life was lost there, which will give you an idea exactly how long that conflict lasted. I got into a slight little twist last time when I was mentioning the Vietnam conflict. Between 73 and 75, we left largely in 73, but it was officially over in 75. That's when Saigon fell. And so anyway, Douglas will clear us up on that. Then, the remainder of the show, Dr. Tim Ball. He is a renowned environmental consultant and former professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg. And his extensive science background in climatology, especially environmental issues and sustainable development, the reconstruction of past climates, and the impact of climate change on human history and the human condition, make him the ideal head of the National Resources Stewardship Project. He works on other things, water resources, pollution prevention, environmental regulations, the impact of government policy on business and economics will be invaluable as NRSP tackles other issues as time goes by. Well, the earthquake that was predicted to occur earlier in the week did not happen, but that does not mean that it will not happen. Several students, full-time students of earthquake behavior, are still, you know, if they miss it by a day or two or a week or even a month, it's no big deal, but this is supposed to be a big one. Some have said somewhere up around Alaska. Some have said down around New Zealand. So in the end, they're tracking it with the best data that they have, but all intelligence is, it's never unambiguous. It's always subject to a little wiggle room. Eric Holder is in a little bit of hot water, as much as he will allow himself to be in. Major news networks, as well as Representative Blake Farenthold, and they're taking to the airwaves to discuss how is it that this information about Fast and Furious lay upon his desk for 10 months. So he either did nothing about it or did not do his job. I'll tell you a quick story. I can't remember where I heard it. But Stalin was about to pass on into the next world, and he summoned Khrushchev to him, and he handed Khrushchev two envelopes. Marked one and two. He told Khrushchev, if you get in trouble, open the first envelope. You get in trouble again, you open the second envelope. Well, the first problem came up, which involved the Berlin situation, and he had to open the first envelope. And on the paper was written, blame it all on me. And so he did. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis came up sometime later, and he opened envelope number two. And inside, there was one sentence, which read, make out two envelopes. It may be time for Mr. Holder to make out two envelopes, because I don't think anybody gave him two envelopes. Otherwise, I think he would have taken a hike by now, but then again, that's just me. I said it many times, and you've said it too, that the internet is probably the greatest tool for learning and knowledge and information gathering on this planet. Absolutely unsurpassed for gathering information. However, there are 10 reasons posted on InfoWars, which is always a good little site to go to, which will make you understand that nothing you do on the internet will ever be private again. The federal government can now retain your internet activity for 5 years, even if you have no links to terrorism. Potential employers are demanding to see your internet activity. Law enforcement is watching you. Government agencies are watching you. The White House is watching you. Truth teams, they'll be scouring the internet for any rumors that are not true as the presidential election comes closer. They're monitoring and recording all talk radio. Hi, for anybody uninvited who's joining our program in progress. Hi, we're watching you too, just so you know. Foreign governments are watching you. We are all being encouraged to spy on one another on the internet. Your ISP is watching you. Your internet service provider is watching you. And the NSA is watching everyone and everything. Don't you feel better about technology just every minute? All right, then. Check the Coast to Coast website. You should always check the Coast website, coasttocoastam.com. There's a lot of interesting stuff on there. Some fantastic artwork by Bill Hoflich. Naps News is there. And, of course, you have an opportunity to become a Coast Insider. And for all of you who have done so, as the radio landscape shifts, you have shifted with it. And we thank you very much for that. That will ensure that there is an uninterrupted flow of non-mainstream media material. Think of Coast to Coast as an oasis of rational thought, hidden in the desert of vacuous content and opinion. All right, we'll be bringing on Douglas Dietrich in just a moment, so cinch down and mount up. The caravan to midnight leaves in 2 minutes on Coast to Coast AM. You know, many of us lost someone in the Vietnam conflict, so this is going to be a little bit sensitive for some. Come on onto the bridge, Douglas Dietrich, and let us set the stage for our talk tonight, because there's a lot of heartbreak still over Vietnam and the people that were lost there.
Yes, and I really thank you for allowing me to address this issue with the American public, because it really needs to be addressed, because we're going through kind of a replay with the wars that we're going through now. And I want the American public to be aware of the fact that Vietnam is actually the norm when it comes to the American way of war and the American style of conflict. World War II, which was a big mobilization war with a lot of involvement with logistics, was very much the exception to the rule. And World War I was also an exception in terms of an expeditionary force on the European continent. The main of majority of America's struggles have been Vietnam-style conflicts, going back to the American Revolution, which was America's longest declared war, 8 years long. And at that time, we were the Viet Cong, and we were fighting the British Empire with a what many would consider a dirty, unorthodox, unconventional form of guerrilla insurgency. And we won ourselves our independence. And going up through to the Vietnam War, there was the Plains Indian Wars, and they were very much the precursor to Vietnam, because there was no strategic points to be taken. Basically, all the American frontier army could rely on was body counts, which people would read about in papers back in the big cities, and they fought their way to the Pacific. And it was very similar to Vietnam in the sense that many of the Indian resistance fighters would cross the Mexican border, or they'd cross the Canadian border, and thereby the frontier army couldn't follow them, because that would be a violation of boundaries and treaties with other sovereign nation states that the United States government recognized federally. And so as a result, you had this precursor all the way up through the Philippine insurgency to Vietnam itself. So this has very much been the norm of America's type of warfare. But Vietnam was by far the longest war we've ever fought, longer by a decade than what seems to be our now infinite war in Iraq. And because it started in 1945, on September 26th, when during unrest in Saigon, the first American death occurred. It was an OSS officer, meaning Office of Strategic Services, and his name was Lieutenant Colonel Peter Dewey, and he was killed by Viet Minh guerrillas. And this was right after he had just filed his report stating in his opinion that the U.S. ought to clear out of Southeast Asia. And you're absolutely right. That's what this holiday has to deal with, is our ultimate withdrawal from Vietnam, which was March 29th of 1973.
You know, Douglas, it's a hell of a thing because we're divided into, it seems like, about three segments.
Yeah.
You have the people that stay home watching their loved ones and their friends go off to these wars. You got the ones that actually do go off to the wars that are actually in the stuff.
Yes.
You know, getting hurt, getting killed.
Yes.
And then you got these prag politicians that are up there orchestrating it all. And so for that, that's why I wanted to talk to you very much, particularly about the commemoration of the end of it. But good Lord, man, this is really kind of a tougher line to try and stay balanced on than I thought it would be because of all the emotion involved between the politicians who don't care, like Lefty said in Donnie Brasco, a guy you don't know sends you out to go kill another guy that you don't know.
Yeah,
and we're supposed to find nobility in that somewhere.
Yeah, if there's a nobility to be found, it's to be found in this. And this is one reason why this holiday needs to be commemorated, to keep it in the minds of everybody, because this was, whether we consider it casual or symptomatic of American decline, this truly was the defining moment in American history in a way that World War II was not. What people don't understand was that we still had the draft, which was ongoing from World War II, and people responded to that draft. And these were working men that responded to it. And there were, of course, about maybe 20 or 30 American women who died in service in Vietnam. But the overwhelming amount in those days was that this was a man's war, and men were answering the call. And these were middle-class men. And this is without resorting to some Marxian tactic of creating a sense of class conflict or warfare. Very much what you had was an upper class or a wealthy American elite, which did not respond to that call. What Americans don't understand in this day and age is that at that time, the wealthy avoided the draft, and they could do so through their connections. They did what they had to do to go on leading their normal lives. But the working men who could not escape due to educational reasons, for instance, you were allowed to escape if you got somehow involved with the teaching profession. And as a result, our educational system, which was the highest in the world during the time of the Kennedy administration, when we were producing engineers so that we could continue Kennedy's dream of colonizing the solar system, ultimately at some point in history, all that came crashing down because that was predominantly, overwhelmingly at the pre-high school level, a female-dominated profession. But a lot of misguided liberal professors thought that they would save a lot of young men from the battlefield, so they invited a bunch of draft dodgers in to teaching positions at the lower levels, pre-high school levels, kicked a bunch of women out of the school system. The end result was you had a bunch of young draft dodgers who didn't know how to teach, who were teaching kids. That's when our educational system crashed. So America crashed at home as opposed to on the battlefield. Because on the battlefield, in a very real sense, in a military sense, the war was essentially won in the sense that the Viet Cong insurgency forces were ultimately eliminated on the field of battle, and the North Vietnamese army was fought to a standstill. So militarily, many things were accomplished, while many things were lost domestically at home in a way that people really haven't comprehended in history yet. And,
you know, Douglas, it's interesting you mentioned Kennedy.
Yeah.
I can't have escaped your notice that actually Joe, the oldest son, was lost in World War II. He was the one that Joe Sr. wanted to groom for high political office, maybe even the presidency.
Yes.
John was actually his second choice, and just a few months after John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated, into Vietnam we go. Do you see the black hand there or what? I do.
I do as well, and there certainly is a lot more to that discussion. That would take us on a course that I want to avoid right now to do justice to the men of the Vietnam War, because those men were products of World War II. That was a time when the wealthy did go to war and were participating almost out of a sense of gentlemanly sport. But in terms of, as a matter of fact, you know, without dwelling on it over much, during the times of Teddy Roosevelt, if you ever take a look at the uniforms of Roosevelt's Rough Riders, the collar insignia say USGV, That stands for United States Gentlemen Volunteers. And those were wealthy men who paid for and raised their own armies to go to war, because war was a sport of kings. And then we went to World War II, where there was still a remnant of that romance. By the time we got to Vietnam, this was a working man's war. And the tragedy is that many of those working men are now listening to us tonight in tent cities. And so this holiday is to bring them to attention, because so many of them are homeless. And I've talked about the homeless problem before, and I definitely want to go over that right now again, because it creates such a enormous amount of our population's problems that we see on the streets. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs admits that on any given day, as many as 250,000 veterans, both male and female, are living on the streets or in shelters, and at least twice as many experience homelessness at some point during any course of the year. And you've got this problem where you've got, for instance, veterans comprising about 6% of the overall population back in 2004, and they were 23% of the homeless. That meant one out of every three homeless men were vets. Today, veterans comprise 9% of the population, but 42% of the homeless. So one out of every three homeless men is still a veteran. And essentially half, 46% of homeless veterans, are my age, that's 45 years old, are older, compared to 20% of the civilian homeless. That's because they're Vietnam vets, the overwhelming majority of them. And the number of homeless male and female Vietnam-era veterans is greater than the number of service persons who, as officially acknowledged, died during that conflict. And even though almost half of homeless vets, about 47%, served in the NAM, the rest come from World War II and every era since, including peacetime, which hasn't existed since 1990 per Title 38 of the U.S. Code. But the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans cites federal figures: more than 67% served our country for at least 3 years, and 35% were stationed in a war zone. Now, what was the cause of this? What was the cause of this was that in 1947, when America was demobilizing, the largest demobilization in the history of the world from World War II, then what happened was they basically said that we've got to keep men reenlisting. And since they won't reenlist, what we're going to do is we're going to make them reenlist by making them unemployable in the civilian world. So they instituted what was known as an SPN, a separation program number, on the DD-214, totally unknown to veterans. This was a cryptic code that had over 500 choices. And all of these over 500 choices were overwhelmingly negative. And the CO, our commanding officer, had total capricious whim, free hand, over everyone's record as to which one of these codes he would apply. And between 1947 to 1974, during that entire period of time, because we pulled out of Vietnam in 1973, then the Pentagon was forced to officially admit to the SPN code and their slanderous secret program, mass defamation program against the majority of their own soldiers, and they were pressured by Democratic Congress to get rid of it. But veterans discharged during the 47 to 74 SPN period still have that marker on their DD-214 to this day. And just to give you an example of what a fraction of what those SPN codes stood for, and by the way, potential employers knew what these were, and they came on every type of discharge: honorable, general, dishonorable, other than honorable. And what would happen would be that job applicants who were vets were required by law to make their DD-214s available to potential employers. And those people in turn would ask the Pentagon or look up the codes in lists that had been published in obscure, unclassified military documents. But employers were well aware of what each code meant, especially at the corporate level, even at the mom and pop level. And but, you know, what they meant were as follows: admission of homosexuality or bisexuality, alcoholism, antisocial, desertion, bedwetting, criminality, drug use, financial irresponsibility, indebtedness, obesity, pregnancy — that was used on women, obviously — disloyalty, subversion, schizoid personality, national security risk, concealment of arrest record. It just went on and on, all the way down to withdrawal of ecclesiastical endorsement, meaning that your chaplain thought you were irreligious, or just lazy, sexual deviant. It was just preposterous. And the omega point of betrayal, and my late father was a victim of this, was personnel records, so necessary for the task of reviewing and reassessing such a sham in both medical and military terms. These were all taken and interned, along with those of many millions of other veterans from many other wars, all going back to the Filipino insurrection after the Spanish-American War, all the way up through the fall of Saigon in 1975.
All right, hold it right there, Douglas. Let's take ourselves a little break, and you just pick up where you left off. Douglas Dietrich, Unknowns About Vietnam, when we return, Coast to Coast AM. It's a Red Flash Saturday night episode of Coast to Coast as we speak with Douglas Dietrich about a day of commemoration for the longest war. We got a close second behind it, but the from 1964 to 1975 and even earlier, with losses going back to 1945. The first OSS man was lost there, Office of Strategic Services, which morphed into the CIA. We will continue with him after a two-minute break. Please stand by. Coast to Coast AM will continue. Wells in with you for the night with Douglas Dietrich. Douglas, so are we to understand that there was like deliberate vilification of these people to keep them within the system?
Just one part of it, sir. That was part of the ultimate betrayal. The omega point of the ultimate betrayal came with their medical and personnel records documents. That could have led to revision of these records, reassessment of these records. They were taken and put into this documentary wicker man called the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri. George Noy, who's going to be with us at the 12th Annual Conspiracy Con in the first 3 days of June of this year, he drives by there pretty much every time he's doing the radio in St. Louis, Missouri. He could tell by the architecture of its concrete abutments and its many feet of barbed wire and the structures being very far in from these external protective barricades that it would be impossible to go in and sabotage it unless you were somebody who worked on the inside yourself. And that's exactly what happened. This architectural fire trap was a combination of a grain silo and a tinderbox. The local municipal fire department protested the fact that neither fire alarms or sprinkler systems were installed, but as the edifice was on federal property, nothing could be done for it. Now, the GSA, the General Services Administration, runs the federal archives. The regional office in the state of California was in San Bruno, and in the course of my primary career as a civilian military librarian, I was able to review an in-house Federal Archives Agency training reel, exposing the fact that 15 starting points of inception instigated the conflagration that consumed this pyre of documents in July of 1975, and the embers of this facility smoldered for over a month, but the Federal Archives Agency had saved the U.S. government billions and billions of dollars in veterans compensation, not to mention obscuring any historical culpability in any atrocities that were cited by those files. As an aside, both Lee Harvey Oswald's and James Earl Ray's military service medical dossiers were conveniently incinerated in that firestorm, just to name a few of the lost celebrity files. And any VA bureaucrat will confirm to this day that the Veterans Administration is still dealing with the repercussions of that arson and will perforce continue to do so until the last Vietnam vet drops dying. And it almost goes without saying that the operations manager of that particular federal facility, and I know this because I was a DOD librarian, he was found with a bullet in his brain, classified as a suicide. They probably came to work too early that day and saw what was going on. And the inferno itself was attributed by the U.S. media to war protesters, a physical impossibility based on what I described. And I spoke about it with George Noy briefly on air before, and he agreed that there's no way any war protesters could get in there and do what was done. The nature of the fire was presented as the functional equivalent of a grain dust explosion in a grain silo, supposedly sourcing from accumulated dust stirred by records activity. And because of that, I had to find, my father was injured in three wars. His tombstone in upstate New York says World War II, Korean, and Vietnam. I had to find three separate witnesses to each wound he suffered in each different war before I could get him recognized for disability. And with that kind of challenge, you can imagine why the average vet from Vietnam or any other war has so much problems proving their disabilities so they can't get medical compensation and they wind up on the streets. And so this is the kind of betrayal that America has presented to thousands of veterans. And we had so many men serving in Vietnam, people don't realize what a chunk it took out of our middle class. Today's war in Iraq and Afghanistan, these are poor man's wars, because now we don't even have that much of a middle class. It's no longer a draft army. So the only people volunteering in the main are enormously poor people. And so this, we've gone from a middle class war of draftees to, after they destroyed anybody's desire to answer that call because of Vietnam, now we've got a so-called professional army of the poor who have no other option in order to put meals in their stomachs. And so this is a situation we're dealing with today. If we confront it with a national holiday recognizing Vietnam Veterans Memorial Day, commemorating it on the 29th of March, celebrating our withdrawal from Vietnam as a kind of homecoming, then we can help with civilian veteran reconciliation. That's how the media got away with it. When they blamed it on war protesters, why would everyone accept that? Because in that day, the Vietnamese, unlike the Japanese in World War II, who had a brilliant way of dealing with the Americans in terms of weapons of mass destruction, ultimately forcing a strategic stalemate and super secret talk down processes, the Vietnamese in the North had what they called Dick Vong. Dick Vong just meant to action among the enemy is the literal translation. And what they did with Soviet support was to get the wealthy classes, which weren't going to war, to support the communist movement. Now, your Vietnam Memorial Wall, which has over 58,000 names on it, wasn't designed by an American. It was designed by an Amerasian, actually a pure Asian young lady, unlike myself, who's Amerasian. Her name was Maya Ying Lin, and her parents fled from communist China when the communists took over the mainland in 1949. And she was so grateful to the Americans fighting communism anywhere on the Asian mainland that she designed the Vietnam Memorial Wall. And during that period of time that she and myself, who was born in Taiwan, came to the United States, along with thousands and thousands of other Vietnamese boat people, Asian immigrants fleeing communism on the Asian mainland, what did we see? The first thing we saw was tens of thousands of white Americans parading throughout all of America's major cities, waving Mao's little red book, portraits of Ho Chi Minh, and quoting Marx and Lenin and saying how great it was that communism was sweeping on the Asian mainland. That's when we all realized, and that's why we all have such a sense of political detachment, we all realized we had jumped out of the fire and into the frying pan. And
well, how about when everybody marched into the Olympics? That was Mao's picture over the door to the big Coliseum where the games were held.
Yes. And it was very much, at that time, America, as I said, won the war on the field. Make no mistake about it. There were at least 50 battles lost in Vietnam. But overall, the American Army, and especially the Marine Corps, had a stellar record in the combat field and accomplished their objectives per their orders. However, what happened at home was more than a disgrace. It was essentially a communist takeover. And that becomes more and more apparent with each and every passing day. And I think that that's what we have to contend with in the future. This is why recognizing this day is so important, so that we can fend that day off, if not permanently, then at least for a generation longer, by keeping that memory alive. Whenever we're fighting about history, we're fighting about the future. And it's only thanks to men such as yourself making this possible that we can do this and help bring it to the attention of people in the United States. The other issue is the veterans that we abandon overseas, which would be the prisoners of war. And, at the end of the Vietnam War in 1973, the U.S. government officially acknowledged about 2,400 men missing in action. Now, on the wall, it's only got listed 1,200 names, which are specified as missing instead of killed. This would mean they're missing in action, prisoner of war, etc. But the reality was, and I know this because I ran the ovens and I burned the records, was that the American government listed 5,000 American soldiers held prisoner by the Vietnamese, and only 591 were repatriated. That means we got only a little over 10% back. And so a lot of people are familiar with the money game behind it. Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Harrington, who worked on the POW MIA issue, dealt specifically with the North Vietnamese and the People's Republic of China from 1973 till 1975, from American withdrawal till the fall of Saigon. And they were quite adamant and open with telling him that U.S. POWs would be returned when the reparations that Kissinger promised to the North Vietnamese were paid. And so that payment, of course, amounted in the billions of dollars in terms of reparations. And the Senate voted 88-3 roll call vote to indicate that aid to North Vietnam would be impossible. And if you ask me, with all of the money that we spend on so much of everything else, we should pay that money to the Vietnamese government today, even if it's just to get bodies back, just on the principle of it. And so that's something that I'm hoping that the American public can be galvanized into again, even though it's far too late for so many of them. As someone who's of Asian background, has Asian connections, I can tell you there were Japanese Buddhist missionaries, monks who were captured by the communists and thrown into prison camps. A few of them said that they were nursed back into health by American prisoners of war, and this was in the 1990s. And so
Oh boy.
that's, you know, this is the kind of nonsense that they tell this on the news in Asia, but you don't hear this here. And so it's something that disgusts me. And believe me, the number of names that are on that wall, the almost 60,000 I mentioned, is well below. It should be twice that number, because what the U.S. government admits to has nothing to do with the reality. There were at least 2,000 airmen lost in Vietnam. And to show you what kind of a war this was and how intense it was, a lot of people talk about Afghanistan as being the Soviet Union's Vietnam. And it was directly on their border. They were heavily engaged in Afghanistan. And yet their commitment to Vietnam was absolutely nothing compared to that of the United States. The largest race riots in American prison history took place not in the United States, but in Vietnam at LBJ, Long Binh Jail, where officers, excuse me, enlisted men who had been responsible for fragging their officers were thrown in the brig. And you had so many men in those brigs, which goes to show you how many officers were fragged, that you had literally thousands of Caucasian and African American soldiers going at each other in those prisons. And that's how many men we had involved. And as a matter of fact, they had their own currency, military payment certificates, during the 27-year period when military payment certificates were in use. And please listen to what I'm saying, numismatic collectors, coin collectors, money collectors. 27-year period shows you how long that war was. There were 13 different issues of these notes, dollar bills with pictures of soldiers in place of presidents. And on the back, instead of architectural places of the White House or Mount Vernon, we had pictures of B-52 bombers. And this is the kind of involvement we had there. And in terms of the Navy, you had cruisers, destroyers, a full flag battleships even conducting offshore bombardment deep into territories in Vietnam. And you had over half the total of combat missions in the North Vietnam were naval aircraft, and over 550 of them were shot down. That's over 500,000 carrier planes. That's over 40 squadrons. With combat losses like that, that's worse than all the carrier battles in World War II combined. And so, if you don't think that this was a monumental conflict that chewed up America and needs to be honored, then I think that you're truly in denial of the historical impact which we see all around us to this day.
The only thing I remember is that Lyndon Johnson came on TV and said that we would commit some forces there, but I don't recall that that it required a congressional approval of any kind. We just went and stayed for over a decade.
And it had its own version of the Pearl Harbor, the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was a false flag incident. That's what led to the commitment of regular troops in Vietnam. Till then, it was special forces. And I do need to say this, they were some of the finest special forces in the world. You've been kind enough to talk about the largest amount of Congressional Medals of Honor going to the 442nd, the Japanese Americans. Well, the only other unit in the American forces that could compete with them would be the MACV SOG, the Military Assistance Command of Vietnam Studies and Operations Group. Very innocuous name. And there were fewer than 100 Americans assigned to it at any one time. They had enormous casualties. I mean, think about what I'm saying. Fewer than 100 Americans assigned at any one time, and yet they had, at points in their history, 100% fatality rate. But for every one of them that died, they killed at least 150 enemy troops. That's how incredibly committed and well-trained these men were. And almost nobody's heard about them. And but to just finalize this with how connected Vietnam is to our history, a lot of people don't understand this, but I've talked before about the Japanese staying on the Chinese mainland till 1949. It's important to emphasize that at the end of World War II, 4,000 Japanese troops joined the Viet Minh, led by Lieutenant Colonel Makuyama, who was later killed in action fighting the French. And these troops included the Kempei Tai, the Japanese military secret police, or their version of the Gestapo. And as a matter of fact, they all served as technicians, trainers with the Viet Minh, and in combat. The entire Japanese 51st Mountain Artillery Regiment, some 900 strong, provided the core around which the Viet Minh would build their first artillery units. So there were also members of the German Asian version of the Africa Corps, which was the Orient Corps. They also became part of the Viet Minh Foreign Legion. This was because East Germany became an ally and accepted many Vietnamese immigrants. There's little Saigons all over East Germany. And,
never heard of such a thing. No one's ever said anything. I've never heard anybody say this except for you.
Ho Chi Minh adopted one of these Nazis who took the name of Ho Chi Long. So this was all a continuity of World War II. Very important to remember that. It's very much hidden from history like so much else. And in the end result was we got to a point with the fall of Dien Bien Phu, which started on March 30th. Keep in mind that March 29th here is March 30th in Pacific Asia because of the international dateline. And what had happened was with Dien Bien Phu, the enormous French garrison, about 10,000 French troops surrounded by 40,000 Viet Minh at the time, the French appealed to the United States to use atomic weapons. And thus was born Operation Vulture. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Arthur Radford, Vice President Richard Nixon, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, all organized it, came up to Eisenhower, and they got two aircraft carriers, entered the Gulf of Tonkin. B-29s were readied at Clark Field in the Philippines. Elements of the 3rd Marine Division were placed on alert. 100 aircraft were involved. 5 U.S. servicemen were captured by the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu. They became the U.S. prisoners of war in the Vietnam War, the first U.S. POWs. And in terms of all this, Eisenhower, when he was presented with all this and they said, we've got to drop 2 or 3 atomic bombs to relieve the garrison, he said, what the hell for? It didn't work on the Japanese. He knew exactly what I've been talking about before on Coast to Coast AM. And he didn't want to.
Well, you know, and Douglas MacArthur said, don't get involved in a land war in Asia. It's a bad mistake. All right, we're down to 2 minutes now, my friend. So tell us, what can we do in furtherance of this commemorative day?
Write your servicemen. We've got a few days before March 29th. Excuse me. Write your representatives, your congressmen, your senators, whoever is your representative. I beg you to do that. And then we can get the ball rolling. I mean, there's nothing else better we can do than that. It's supposed to be a participatory democracy. If we participate, we can get this happening. I'd also like to take advantage of this time to invite you to join us for an on-site live feed broadcast. From the lobby of the Santa Clara Marriott during the first 3 days of June at the Conspiracy Con for 2012. George Norrie's going to be there. Brian Sussman's going to be there. They need no introduction. Neither does John B. Wells. And I'm hoping that this will be an opportunity for them to meet you. Once they find out how intimidating you look, they may be reluctant to call in the future, but at least we'll get that started. And please go to my website. I talk about such things in my DVD package. We're going to sell them till we run out of our current run of DVD sets. We're offering towards this end 2 DVDs for the price of 1 at DouglasDietrich.com, www.DouglasDietrich.com. All the information you need on Conspiracy Con will be there as well, the schedules for it. You can look it up or Google or search engine it. As for a personal appearance, I'll be speaking at the 2012 Summit. Please look that up on my website this Saturday, May 12th of this year. I'm really looking forward to the Super Soldier Summit, It's going to be in Bergen County. We can't give the location of the exact venue to anyone for security.
We'll put the word out.
Buy the ticket.
We'll put the word out, brother. Thank you for coming on the show. We'll be talking again soon. Douglas Dietrich, always an unusual perspective. Always good. This is Coast to Coast. Stand by.